Good day, Vashon Mori Island. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm so glad you've joined us today here at our island's own Voice of Vashon on 101.9 FM, KVSHLP Vashon. You're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, a conversation-style interview show highlighting authors from around the world who seek in their own creative way to inspire all of us to be the best we can be. And now, on with the show. So, Zoe, I'm really, really glad that you were able to call in today. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're in the Seattle area.
Yes, I'm currently in the U District waiting for the quarter to start up. I'm really excited to be in person classes. I'm a junior, so I don't know what all the freshman events are going to look like, where they forced us all to mingle. So I don't know if they'll be required to do that anymore.
Right. And yet, of course, what was the name? I think it was Isaac Newton. Yeah, the Black Plague was going through Europe in the 1700s, and Oxford or whatever fancy university he was at got shut down for like 3 years. So he went home to the family, whatever farm in the country, in order to avoid the Black Plague. That's a good thing to avoid. And apparently it was there by himself without having teachers tell him what to think or what to learn, just sort of on his own, that he started doing the things that allowed him to come up with his ideas around what, gravity, relativity? I'm not sure, but like, yeah.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah. I wonder what would have happened to his mind and his creativity if the Black Plague had not come through.
True. Yeah. I don't know. I definitely being alone in my apartment going to school, I was just writing, and I don't know if I could have written the same stuff if I was in school. So it's interesting to think about.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm so glad you brought that up. So actually real quick. So make sure I'm pronounced this correctly. Zoe Hannah Makuta.
Yes. That's perfect.
Excellent. All right, everyone. So Zoe is joining us here on Prose, Poetry, and Purpose to discuss Gearbreakers, which is the first book in a duology. And so that's such a brilliant point that you just brought up, the effect of this pandemic specifically on writers has been really sort of a mixed bag. So for you, what you're saying that it actually allowed you to feel you had more time for your creativity.
Yeah, definitely. It was a thing where March 2020, UW was on the quarter system, so we were actually all home for spring break before they told us not to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom called me, and she's like, please come home immediately. And I was like, okay. So I was in Colorado for the majority of 2020, and then January, beginning of this year, came and got my first apartment in Seattle. I was all alone. Took classes off because I didn't want to do Zoom University, and I just wrote. And that was really, it was just nice because I was just like, this is what I want to do when I graduate, and I'm just doing it now. So it was pre-Gearbreakers launch. All the edits were done, and I was working on the sequel, just going along with that, working on a third book, and it was just weird. I had spent like a ton of time alone, and I was just like having such a good time with it, because I think like first and foremost, like I'm telling the stories I write to myself at first, which is like, I don't know, it's just like a trend in my life. Definitely when I was like little, would tell myself bedtime stories type of thing, and now I'm just doing it on a more adult
Mom comes in. Do you want me to read you a story? Mom, you interrupted me. I'm in the middle of my own.
I think that literally happened a couple times. So funny.
Oh my gosh. Well, okay, so this is exciting for me to hear, because while obviously we all know that there is the tragedy aspect of, you know, what's going on so many levels with this pandemic. And that is not just related to the virus. It's related to how humans are responding and the effects that has upon people. It's also, for me, I've always been, and I think you mentioned this earlier in our pre-chat, that one of the themes that you're trying to bring out is the idea that even when things look really, really bad, and I'll let you speak to it. You know, there's that sense of, you know, you can, I don't know, for me, it's making lemonade out of lemons. And so I just feel like sometimes I just want to accept the status of things are not excellent. And then instead of freaking about it, I'm like, well, so how can I best respond and make this as healthy and productive for me as possible? And I just can feel my whole body relax when I sort of think that way. It sounds a little bit like you just pivoted.
Yeah, I think it's definitely like one of the things I was trying to get across in Gear Breakers was like no matter how bad the world gets, there's always good that can be found. Like, it's never all bad, because I don't know, maybe like maybe it's just like that thing where like you can't, it's not a thing that you have to think until it's true. And I don't think it's ever true, because you have like how you're looking at the world, and you have hopefully other people and how you're looking at them and how they're looking at you. And there's trying to organize my thoughts.
No, this is, I mean, that's the whole point, is that this is actually really, you know, we can say attitude matters, and that's two little tiny words, but it's really a deep, tremendously deep topic.
Yeah, it's so like, I don't know, this is like a sideways rant, but like, it's definitely in my English classes, I have learned how restrictive language is. It's like, some stuff is just like, because like, language has ends. Like, there's a finite amount of language, but there's not like a finite amount of like human expression or like human thoughts. Oh my gosh, it's like way in the opposite direction. But
absolutely. No, I mean, if you had a human that was raised in a community that didn't have any spoken language whatsoever, and you were to interface or understand what was going on inside the mind of that human at the age of, you know, 20, if they had never engaged in spoken language, it doesn't mean that they would just have this incredibly different way of interacting with the world and perceiving it, but it wouldn't be inaccurate. It would just be dramatically different. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. I think like when I was talking about this exact thing with my friend the other day, and he was like, oh, like the language is limiting, like how else can you express yourself? And he's like, oh, I guess like you have language and then you have art, and maybe that like makes up the entire spectrum of expression. But then that's difficult, because writing is like a language based art. So like, I'm just here. I'm stuck here. I get really shy when people are asking me about it, like, except in an interview, because that's, like, the purpose of it. But if it comes up in conversation, I'm like, oh, it's like, no, I'm, like, trying to downplay it, because I was like, Gear Breakers is the one that's out, and I wrote it when I was, like, 18, and I know, like, I'm, like, just such a different writer now. I think I've really leaned into my voice and distinctified myself.
But you know what? That happens to every writer I talk to.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I mean, you know, you might want to check out some of my interviews, because they are, you know, right now I'm focusing specifically on currently publishing women authors of fiction. Mm-hmm. So these, it's a whole, and I did slip in Garth Stein. He's a personal friend. He wrote a book about the island I live on. So I'm like, I'm breaking the rule and bringing you in. But, you know, I mean, these, like, let's see. Michelle Segarra West. Oh my gosh. You know, she didn't start writing, I don't think, like at a really super young age like you. I think it was a little bit later, but she still speaks about, you know, how her voice changed over time. And, you know, so this happens to everyone no matter when they start. And that's just, I think, a good thing. It means you're actually writing. You can't write. I guess you could write and not change. Let's hope that wouldn't happen. So,
yeah, I guess you're right.
So, world building, you said you had sort of everyone who creates, real quick. So, is Gear Breakers fantasy or dystopian in your view?
It kind of all walks the line between like sci-fi, dystopian, and fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I do have like the cyberpunk tropes and
right.
world with the ginormous robots, but the fact that they are worshipped as gods, like it kind of blends that line. It walks that line a little.
And it's Earth in the future.
Yes, but like far, far future. I think I specify in the second book that it's around like the 40th century.
Like, yeah, because I noticed that, you know, like in The Hunger Games, which a lot of people have heard of it and they recognize it as dystopian, they're still reflecting back upon, you know, you're in the, quote, United States. You know that the modern history of the moment is still a remembered history for those people. But in Gear Breakers, I didn't, you know, the names are very different. I didn't quite get the sense of them having a close memory of the current times. So it felt to me quite distant.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, far enough in the future where, like, our present has been forgotten or just, like, it just, like, doesn't matter of, like, what they're facing right then. But I was definitely, like, just with the religion, I'm very interested in religion. I have a minor in history of religion right now. I just wanted to blend that with science fiction, so I, like, set up the Gearbreakers world as like the religion that's dominant at the time is has been completely eclipsed with technology,
mm-hmm.
and it's like it's implied that like so I think if you're going from the scale of like where we are in the present and you have like the medieval times and they're worshiping like ecclesiastical gods type of thing, it's
right.
like that same distance. Except, like, that same distance from the standpoint of the Gear Breakers, except those gods were always robots type of thing. Or, like, it was always, like, blended with technology.
Right, which sort of makes sense a little bit when we look. I think it could make sense for a modern reader right now as they're living in a world where technology is becoming so, if it isn't physically embedded into your body yet, it is embedded into your patterns, your habit. You know, what's the first thing that most people do when they wake up in the morning? Reach over and grab their phone. Yeah! You know, and I mean, when I grew up, the phone was over in the living room attached to the wall and you had to go sit on the couch and use it, right? And it was, you had an alarm clock. It was
better.
So different. So I imagine it makes a lot of sense for people to see how that, you know, one thing I find really fascinating, and I hear that you have the same appreciation sort of for human history and whatnot, is that we as average common people, and I don't mean that in an insulting way, I mean that is actually it's a positive term.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The it's like the salt of the earth common people, you know? We tend to really place a lot of value on what's happening right now at this moment. And we look back a generation or two and forward a generation or two. And yet, then I'll think, and this happened when I went to Rome, it really made me start thinking about what's the point of view of the Catholic Church?
Mm-hmm.
Because they codified themselves around 300 AD, and they have made it through the Middle Ages. They've made it through the Enlightenment. They've made it through, you know, industrial era. They've made it through, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, they expect to be here 2,000 years from now. They already made it almost 2,000 years.
Yeah,
so what's your view of Earth if you expect 2,000 years from now to still have influence and effect? The Catholic Church is sitting here and they're like, well, we were around 1,700 years ago. We'll be around 2,000 from now. And what does that do to a person's worldview? It's sort of like if you were a vampire and you're going to live forever, how would you view the world differently than someone who's got three more decades? It's just interesting.
Yeah, wow, that's so interesting. There's like a permeance to it. It's so interesting. That's why I love religion. I think it has a lot of overlap with language, and that like it, like they determine like how you like the boxes in which you like organize the world So it's like almost, it's so hard. It's so interesting, but it's like so hard to think of like, where would I be? And like, yeah, but like, where would I be? How would I be thinking if I was Catholic and not vaguely pagan?
Or if you were going to live for the next 1,000 years, what would you care about? I mean, wouldn't it like change? You know, so I'm curious because I never finish a book before I do an interview as a way of preventing myself from actually being able to slip a spoiler in there. So I'm curious, the Valkyrie, is there a lifespan?
Ooh. I've never been asked that question before. It's so interesting. I guess, like, I think in my head I was having it so, like, the mechas were, like, they're attached to the pilots, like, you know, a pilot will probably only pilot one mecha,
right?
And because the evil nation of Gadolia is like pumping out these war machines with such like efficiency, they like, it's not even a thought that like, oh, I'm gonna be in someone's used mecha,
right?
But I guess like it's a thing of like, these mechas are idols, they're gods, and I really wanted to, like, examine religion through that medium because it's like, oh, like, they're just pieces of metal, but as soon as you start worshipping them as gods, they're gods. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm just thinking of, like, just mechas that don't have pilots, and they're just still there, and they're still, they are gonna still be, like, worshipped as idols. And I think like the pilots like more vessels at that point, but it's like, yeah, it's a recognition of like they're fleeting, but there is a sense of legacy, I guess, that goes on because like, unless you like break down the mecha, it's still there and it's still going to be an idol.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, the Easter Island.
Oh, yes.
Right?
So interesting.
And, of course, we're just sitting around trying to even figure out what those things mean.
Yeah, like
how'd you make them? How'd you move them?
Never going to know.
I know, right? That's the hard thing about archaeology and history is that people are like, they'll read a history book, and they're like, oh, we know this. And then I'll be like...
Yeah, and you're like...
That's like a best guess by historians based upon like 9 half scribbled letters from people who were actually talking third person about 4 other people, and you're just trying to put it together and come up with this idea, and then someone like, oh, I'll make a movie out of it, like we know everything about that human, and I'm like, and you know, it's
so funny.
History. Then you get into relevancy, you know, as another theme. It's like, you know, this question. So this is something I really, when I speak to someone who is starting their adult life, and the first thought I have is this curiosity about how are you viewing the world at your age as you step into it compared to, you know, like my island where I live and create this awesome show here for Voice of Vashon has an average age of 55. We have a lot of baby boomers here, a lot of retirees, you know, a very much older age demographic. And in fact, the people in the 20s are known to pretty much like, there's hardly no one in their 20s. They like disappear because they go off. And some of them come back in their 30s to have kids, right? That type of idea. But for those of us who are baby boomers, which is actually my parents' generation, or even me, I think, I'm Generation X. Yeah. It was sort of like, you know, the world is your oyster and just, you know, life is good. Go out, get a job. You know, nothing's going to do whatever you want to do. It's this big world just waiting for you to discover it. And right now, I think there's a different feeling in the youth about the world. And I'm wondering if you wanted to speak a little bit to how you and your friends, fellow classmates, you know, people of your generation, what's going on with your perspective, and what might you want the people who are older, who already have invested power and influence, what is it that you might want us to recognize or think about or do differently as we influence the world going forward?
Yeah, I guess I'll start off with, oh my gosh, I'm still at the point where it's so weird where people will call me an adult and I'll be like, oh, they're joking. Oh, wait, they're not joking. It's so weird. Like, especially like, it's like, I'm still very new to like being on my own. Like, even out of the dorms, it's a huge shift from like being alone in my apartment. And like, there's a sense of like being beholden to no one, and I can like literally do whatever I want. Like, I don't know who allowed this, but it's like I'm a child, so it's so odd. But I'm an adult, like,
right?
I don't know. It's like, yeah, it's just like a weird transitionary stage.
Yeah.
And I think my perspective on things is definitely shifting because of that, because it's like I'm more alone, so I can like kind of figure out like how I alone am looking at stuff, instead of like maybe I was influenced by like my parents or like other grown-ups that were in my life,
right?
Or like consistently in my life. Like, I'll mostly now like just call my mom and have like a conversation, but like once I hang up, like, she can't, you know, there's no one who can tell me what to do except for me. It's so weird. So I'm like definitely forming new
when everyone you
outlook.
Know is in a similar boat too. I mean, you must be surrounded by young people. Even when you leave your apartment, when you take a break from your book, you know, and you go to the local boba tea place or coffee shop, or you're in a classroom. I mean, you know, it's got to be, yeah, you're hearing a whole bunch of voices that are not parent voices, that's for sure.
Yeah. At the same time, though, I think I'm like having the same that just like you mentioned, like the same experience as like other people my age who are like, you know, specifically my peer circle. I don't think I can speak so widely, but definitely like people I see on the internet and like on social media. Like, I think my generation, like, we're very cognizant of like the world we are growing up into and how like it's kind of like, oh my gosh, kind of dire, to be honest, like with just like so much like military problems, like too much money being pumped into the military. We have environmental issues like above all of that,
right?
It's just like we're very keen to all of it, and it's like resulted in like almost like a streak of nihilism. I can definitely recognize it in like the humor of my generation, like the stuff I find funny. Like, my parents will look at me like I'm morbid. I'm like, oh, maybe it is morbid type of thing. But I think it's also like, I don't know. I think like because of that, like we're, my generation like might be a little like freer in thinking, just like about like, I guess like I'll just take like identity for one, like,
right? Yeah, let's like, go there for sure.
Yeah, especially like I think, like, because like we're so cognizant of like how close the world is to ending, we care less about like any traditional thought that came before us, and like we're kind of not like binding ourselves to anything. Because like maybe there won't be anything soon, so like, see, I'm like laughing about it now. I do think it's funny.
No, I think it actually is incredibly emotionally understandable in a way. It's like, you know, it's that idea of you can laugh or you can cry.
Yeah, definitely, you know? A coping thing, I think, if I think on it. It's fine. Yeah, but I think it's just like, I don't know. And then above all that, you know, not above all that, but like beside that, you have like the fact that you can get like a full college education and come out of school with a lot of debt and still like not specifically being able to get a job, just because like that's the direction the world is. But it's like a thing where I think we also take that with a grain of salt. Like, we take things like, people are how they are. The world is how it is. So, like, let's just do whatever besides that. Like, we'll deal with it. But I think there's definitely a direction toward, I don't know. Just,
well, that's
like
a form of resiliency.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is interesting. I feel like acceptance the concept of acceptance, of course, you know, whether you're looking at it from a philosophical perspective or whatever, mm-hmm. in general, that's that word encompasses, like, you could write 89 books about it. And, but one thing is, like, there's this, I was born in 72, and my parents were multiple college educated, very aware of what was going on with the environment, with society, and not, like, my mom and I were just talking this morning, and she made a comment. She said, I don't think there was ever a newspaper in our house when you grew up as a child, ever. And I'm like, no, I don't remember ever seeing a newspaper, because they knew enough to question, you know, the curated narrative that would be offered to them by the people who would control what came out in the newspaper. And so they were aware of climate change long before it became this little battle on television where you had talking heads discussing whether it was or was not going on. My mom got an environmental studies degree. And so I lived through this period where there was this awareness of this thing that could be anticipated. I mean, back in the 50s, they were putting those balloons up in the air and checking, you know, the air quality. And of course, we now know in the 70s that the oil industry was informed by their own scientists. And they're like, well, that's not good for money, so we're going to shut that down. You know, so I grew up with a family that was aware of these things. And there was this emotional distress because was this thing that hadn't happened yet. And yet humans were moving towards it. And there was all this distress around, would we be able to stop the humans or redirect them so that that wouldn't happen? And that, I think, was more emotionally harmful, distressing than this moment I feel like we're at right now where it happened. It occurred. I've accepted it. And at that moment, I actually feel almost more relaxed, like, okay, now it's just a matter of how do I want to deal. It's like this panicky feeling you get about, can I stop it from happening? But once it's happened, well, okay, now I just have to figure out what to do about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's interesting the word you used, resilience. I think, like, definitely I'm, like I said, like, we're taking it all with a grain of salt because it's like, that is a form of acceptance, right?
Right.
Very Buddhist. It's also very nihilist.
You're right.
All of that. I think it's like, I don't know. I think it's like, what are you gonna do when we, you know, there's people like who are older than us who still have power, and for now we can just kind of like what can we do, like, as we wait to, like, inherit that, like, what is the state of the world gonna be from that? And I think, like, for me, like, I definitely sat down and thought about this when I've had, like, more panicky moments about it, because I'm like, oh my god, like, I, like, what do I do? Like, how can I fix? Which is, like, so much. I'm like one person, and I'm like,
right.
I need to, like, save the world type of thing, or I just need to, like, help, you know? And I think, like, this thing where I'm like, I'm not like a STEM person. I'm not gonna get, like, an environmental sciences degree because I just like I wouldn't be very effective with any of it. I think the best thing I can do is write, which is, like, sounds ridiculous, but I can put ideas into other people's heads, and I think that's a little bit of power. I think it's how I can do the most good in the world.
I don't think that's what I do. Yeah, I don't think that is at all a minor thing. I mean, it's like, I'm not sure if you had books that you turned to when you were going through, like, middle school and high school years, or you were just having a rough time. But for me, I had books that I've read multiple times, because when, you know, really the peers around me were just sort of, like, not worth spending time with. They were all emotional messes and, you know, whatever. I could go spend, you know, 4.5 hours reading that book, and that character just would fill my heart up and remind me that if she could do it, I could survive my trials and tribulations if she could get through that. And in a way, if you can create, as you have through this, you know, the story, you're creating mentors in a way, and role models, and but not in a lectury way at all. It's just like there's people out there that are doing amazing things, but we may not hear about them because the news oftentimes is all about what's bad, bad, bad. But mm-hmm. there's people doing incredible things, and if we can't hear about them, well, gosh, golly, at least we can read about them. You know, right?
So. Yeah, you're putting it in much better words than I am, which is often the case when I'm talking out loud.
Well, okay, so tell us a little bit, world building. What was your process for that?
Yeah, so like for Gearbreaker specifically, it's just like I had what is a very classic dystopian setting, which is like you first is like very far in the future, nuclear war after nuclear war, and it's like all the earth is a fried spot. And then I had, so like that's what I started with, is like I literally draw it out of my head. I'm like, okay, I'm above like this big blank desert, let's add a city. So I put a city, and it's like, oh, I'm gonna make it like all sleek and metropolitan and cyberpunk. So it's like, ooh, it's like a rot growing into the blankness of the desert. That's how I kind of set it up. It's literally like, it's like a little video game in my head. So I like draw it out in my head, and it's like so fun because I like, once I do that with any like story, I can like just like look back into it at any time I choose, like no matter what else I'm working on. It's just like sets. Abandoned in my head.
You know, think of Dubai. I mean, yeah. The humans do create these giant, I mean, I'm looking at a picture right now. It's on Wikipedia, calls Economy of Dubai, but it's this incredible, it's exactly what you just said, shiny, glittery, tall, beautiful thing surrounded by desert that will kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just like, and then I definitely wanted to like weave in some like thematic elements right into the physical setting. So you have like good old sleek metropolis, kind of cold and metal, and then you have blank Badlands desert, and then like around that you have like before the mountains start, you have like these fringes of like groves of trees that have somehow managed to grow, and like in that greenery is where I like put the Gearbreaker's base, because it's like just like very, very obvious, very like easy thematic implications there.
Sure.
With the growth. But yeah, definitely wanted like,
did you draw it out, like, you know, I mean, was it always just words on a screen, or did you do flashcards, you know, what type of other physical expression, you know, or research into the world? I'm sort of curious about where you went with that.
Yeah, I definitely, like, it was definitely more on the page than anything else. I didn't have to, for some reason, this round, I didn't draw it out. I don't think I usually do that. Sometimes I'll do that when I'm, like, cement myself in it, but I don't remember anything for your figures, actually.
Mm-hmm. So but it's really like, in your mind.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And I think, like, it's, like, kind of comedic, right? Because I, like I said, not a STEM person, said everything so far in the future that no one can check me on any of my science, but like for like just for like the cybernetic enhancements specifically, that's what I was doing like most of my research.
Right.
So I was kind of like to like, because for the cyborgs that control the mechas, like they have like a, their nervous system is rendered painless, but it can also be turned off and on. So I was like researching like nervous systems, mm-hmm. like how I know that there's 42 miles of nervous system in a person, which is ridiculous.
Random. Okay, that was, you're going to do well when you play that. What's that game where you're supposed to know Trivial Pursuits?
A Trivial Pursuit. Yeah, like maybe that's my time to shine.
Yay!
And you're talking about body anatomy.
Right.
It's kind of cool. Like, and then I was researching, like, how eyes work, because that's a big mod element in Gearbreakers.
Right.
And I found, like how they connect in the back of the brain, and how, like, they kind of flip the images. They, like, take in the image upside down for some reason, flip it.
Right.
So it's, like, which is weird. It's just weird. So.
No, absolutely. It's the body. The body in and of itself, you know, people are like, oh, let's go explore the universe. Yay! And then someone else says, well, let's explore inward. There's a whole giant, you know, what's the the microbiome project, I think, or it's not the genome project, but this is, if I understand correctly, I think we're basically about 10% human, in that 10% of the, how do you put this? You have all these cells, you have all these pieces that can be counted up, and you say that equals March the human. And then within that ecosystem, there's all these other things that are smaller that live throughout, within, and around. And apparently they outnumber me by a lot.
Oh my goodness. I did not know that. Yeah, it's like bacteria or something. That's what I thought I heard,
yes.
Which is a little terrifying. Not going to think about it.
But I think of myself as like a walking planet, you know, it's just on planet March.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Yeah, totally. So you know, we've got Zoe beans and March beans. They should all get together for a party sometime. Oh,
so
gosh.
Funny.
Creepy sci-fi book being planned out as we speak.
Literally, yeah. Also, like, tech advances so rapidly. It's definitely like an exponential slope.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so, I don't know. It's mind-boggling.
There's always been this sort of idea that science is usually 30 years ahead of where society's at. Like, you know, like there's all these amazing things that are being discovered that are actually real. They're working and all that, but they're definitely not implemented at a level where society is engaging with them. But
But
with things going faster, you have to wonder if maybe science is only 15 years ahead of us because we're moving so much faster to catch up with it.
Yeah.
I
definitely, like, that's why I really like the science fiction genre, is, like, I love how it's, like, the only genre that, like, comes from the implication of, like, human intellect. Like, it's so interesting to me.
Oh, that's actually really a great point. You're right. The primary driving power and force of it is humanity.
Yeah, which is why I think it's definitely, like, a good medium to, like, explore the
yeah.
of humanity. Cause especially, like, in Gearbreakers, like, I have like Sona's a cyborg, and she has to, like, she really grapples with humanity, like, in that physical respect.
Mm-hmm.
And something she has to get past, how it's like, it's not just like humanity is, like, not just a physical concept.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's sort of, what is that? That's the idea of, Oh my gosh. Oh, what is it? Our AI.
I definitely want to do something with AI at some point, but that's like a, that requires so much. Like, I have to do more research on that. And also, it's like a thing that's kind of terrifying, to be honest. So.
I agree pretty much. Yeah. I mean, it's that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't, I don't know. I'm approaching 50, and it's interesting because I can remember being in my 20s, and my dad was 25 when I was born. So I always think to myself, you know, at any point that I was hanging out with him, you know, he was 25 years further than I was, right? It was always that 25 gap. And I remember when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and I just sort of was like hot and bothered about, you know, I can't believe people are doing this. How can they think that way? Why? You know, I don't understand. This is so, you know, and my poor daddy could, like, listen long enough. And I remember he would always put his hand up in the air and he'd just be like, you know, humans. And he had been a historian. It was his degrees were into the Middle Ages was focus. And so I could just see him. He's like, humans did it.
That's so,
you know,
good.
In the Roman era, they did it in the Middle Ages. It's like, they're doing it, honey. It's just, I'm tapped out. That's what humans do. You know, and I'm all like idealistic, but we could do it better. And he's looking at me like, oh, honey. Now I'm like almost 50 and I'm scratching my head going, okay, fine.
Yeah.
Well, then do I care anymore? Maybe I just want to go to a little island alone and just ignore all this ridiculousness.
Basically. That's so funny. And yes, I'm going.
Oh my god. So you have defund the military as one of the themes that you really wanted to have coming out of this world, the story you created. Where does that come from, and what does that mean for you?
I think that just comes from living in America.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you just look at, I've seen just so many statistics for right. like just like comparing like U.S. military budgets everywhere else, and it's like the scale is literally like, it's literally ridiculous, and that's what I made it ridiculous in Gear Breakers, where it's just like Gidoli is pumping out all of these mechas,
right.
and they're literally the only ones left on the planet. Like, I don't know, like, they're just, it's just like something that I wanted to come across is that it all comes from like this state of fear,
right?
Like that something's out to get you is like why we're having weapons and like just like basically making up enemies, because or like basically just making up the worst scenario, preparing for the worst. And I don't think that's any way to live, like even on an individual level, but like if you are having it on a national level, like that just becomes like, it's just like, I don't know, it's like the furthest thing from being a humanitarian, I think, even though
right.
like you are doing it in the you're saying you're doing it with the pursuit of protection, but mm-hmm. it's just fear. So
yeah, that amygdala back there. Ooh, I just had an idea. Okay. You know, you've got dystopian, then you have utopian. And of course, utopian is sort of creepy because it's supposed to show you that usually control and force is part of how you create this perfect world. And of course, we all know that control and force is a bad idea. We all know this, right?
Mm-hmm,
2021, United States of America. Hello, everyone. Coercion's bad. Okay, I'm just going to throw that out there. I think people are forgetting. But, so, utopian does this, right? Well, imagine if the way someone created a utopia was they went in and they removed or eliminated the amygdala.
Ooh.
Right?
No fear.
Right? I mean, if humans on planet Earth were spending all their energy and time on something other than being scared of each other, and all this work we do to try to create this sense that we're safe and protected from enemies, what else would we be doing with our time, energy, and effort?
Yeah, that's so interesting. Also terrifying.
I know.
So interesting.
I'm sure we can come up in our imagination with some way that would be horrible, but I think your point is incredibly well made. And the maybe the bigger question is, why have humans not yet managed this?
Well, yeah.
Why does the amygdala still rule the world?
Yeah. Honestly, might just be like animal instinct. You know, you have that thing of like you have your monkey brain that's like trying to protect you.
Yeah.
Like, I don't. Like, I went up in the Space Needle this past summer, and I they have that floor where it's just, like, glass, and you're looking, like, 500 feet down.
Yeah. Thank you. My
and
stomach
like
just flipped visualizing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right? But, like, exactly, because you're standing on the glass floor, and you're, like, my logical brain is saying, like, there's no way that I can, like, there's no danger here. But then your monkey brain is, like, flipping your stomach and being, like, we can't be, like, can we please go somewhere else? Can we please go anywhere else?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, I believe the conscious mind, the frontal cortex, that we have the ability to intentionally override our amygdala. The problem is if we aren't trained, raised, educated, informed, encouraged, inspired, pick your word, I don't care what it is. If we don't gain that ability, then we are just, it just drives the car. It's
totally.
Just in control.
Completely.
And yeah. I mean, it's funny, like, you know, I've got like something will come up, let's say, you go see a doctor and they're like, oh, we think we have a weird test result or something. You know, you can feel it. You can feel, you know, this cold rush that goes over your body. And then suddenly, you know, you're tense because there's that little warning is going off. And I'll be like, well, first, that's not helpful. Secondly, now I feel like crap. And thirdly, I don't, you know, it does me no good. So I'll have to like sit there and breathe and like, you know, and intentionally do what I need to do, release all that. And I have this, these words that go through my head. It's like, what will be, it is what it is. So
it is what it is.
Just deal with it.
Yeah.
Just, there's do, like, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think there's like this meditation practice. I don't know what school of thought this comes from, but it's just like, observing your emotions and like being like, okay, how, like, why is this here? And like, how is it actually serving me? Cause like, once you recognize like that, like your body's trying to, I think, protect you, then it's like easier to be like, it's okay. I'm just gonna like leave it there. And like,
mm-hmm.
it'll be fine. Like kind of thing. It will. Yeah. Like, just like you said, I like that mantra.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that, and when I was younger, I don't think I had, I developed that skill because I needed it, because when I was younger and something weird would happen, it's like suddenly, you know, I'm nauseous and anxious for, you know, the rest of the day or, you know, a week or whatever. And, but along the way, I was like, well, that's not useful. That's not helpful. That's unpleasant. Mm-hmm. I want to be doing it differently, you know? But imagine if that was a curriculum for kids in school.
Right? It's just like a mindfulness. So important. Definitely should be taught.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my goodness gracious. Emotional, physical connection and health.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, who knows? Things are going to be a lot different. I legitimately think so.
Well, Earth with humans. It's interesting. So let's see here. You wanted, I actually, it was so exciting when you said you wanted to talk about this because I already had it on my list. So when I was growing up, born in the early 70s, and from California, so like my mom in particular had a lot of friends who back then, they were just lesbian or gay. We didn't have the LGBTQ and the other 9 letters that have been added because we have much greater awareness now. But back then it was, you know, the 70s, it was the 80s, it was the beginning. And, or it was not the beginning, actually really not the beginning at all, but it was a moment of awareness. And one of the things I remember really bothered me, because these were just people I grew up with, people in my life, and, you know, they just were great people. And then I remember, like, there's that movie, Silence of the Lambs. Have you ever heard of it?
Yes, I know that movie.
Right. Okay, good. I don't want to assume anything. And I remember, I love the movie, but it really bothered me that they made the creepy, horrible, awful, bad dude out to be that way, basically because this person was, they were trying to allude to transgender. I was really bothered that mainstream Hollywood was still framing people who were in the queer community as somehow being outside of normal, unhealthy, dangerous, and all that. And so that's like what I was going through as I was stepping into my adulthood. Mm-hmm. And right now it's obviously a completely different landscape depending on what country you live in. And I'm wondering, you have this, you've brought into your story and you wanted to talk about it a little bit. So how are things different now? How are they hopefully better? And what is it you wanted to say?
Yeah, so I think... like, I'm bisexual, and I realized that when I was writing Gearbreakers, actually, like, very worried up to the point. I was like, I'm fetishizing sapphic relationships. And then I was like, oh, I'm just being dumb type of thing. But I think I don't want to use the word mainstream, but I guess that's, like, I guess that's accurate, like, in comparison to, like, historically how it's been for queer people, where, like, they're not, it's not exactly something that's, mentioned or talked about in media as much, except for, I guess, like, more recently in my generation, definitely becomes more of the norm. I also don't like using that word, but, like, definitely a sense, like,
it's not as if the norm is the goal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I guess mainstream would be the, that doesn't sound right, but definitely, like, there was a more traditional standard of normal, which automatically creates a sense of othering. I think it's less prevalent now. Definitely still an issue in regards to identity mm-hmm. now, but I didn't grow up on, but that was all media, and non-written media, and I was wanting more books with that kind of representation where I could feel seen. Mm-hmm. Apparently, this is like a subconscious process, I guess, cause, like, I was already writing it, but just wanted, I just wanted that kind of story, so I wrote it for myself, and then
that's
now
really
I can write
amazing.
It for other people.
So I think that's really, really awesome. That's a good reminder that writing is not just for the readers, it's also for the writer.
Oh, definitely. I think it, really helped me. I guess it did help me come to terms with it. That sounds like I had a negative thing to begin with, but it's mm-hmm. just, more, I think, compulsive heteronormativity is, definitely a thing. It's because, there's definitely, a base of assumption that, people are straight and cis, I think. I think it's also interesting to see, my generation, you definitely have, a greater percentage of people just, very comfortable with labeling themselves some kind of queer term.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say, there's more queer people than there were 50 years ago, but just that there's, I don't know, it's, more oh, here I am, this is how I exist. I just, not trying to limit people in that, because it's definitely a thing where, people will use labels. I use the term bisexual for myself, and I'm mm-hmm. But some people also, don't use labels. They're not comfortable with it, and I feel like people in my generation are also cool with that. People can just, kind of be however. And
right.
I think it's, something that's, less pointed at, but more celebrated, if that makes sense.
Oh, it's so interesting listening to you actually elaborate on this, because it's also reminding me of what you said earlier in the interview about the power of language to impact our view of the world or our way of thinking. It's you keep sort of stumbling into words that had relevancy or made sense in a past time. Now it's a new time. Things are different. And the words don't quite apply. So how do you communicate what's in your mind that you're trying to get across using the old language?
Exactly. I definitely think there's a point where, I don't know. I don't think people need to be identified, but
mm-hmm.
definitely, a thing where it's just, humans like to compartmentalize like that.
Yeah.
So, it'd be cool if we have new language to express ourselves, but also cool if people, just don't jive with that, because, it's not, one experience or even a group of people's experience is not everyone, capital E's experience. With assumptions, you also have expectations, and
yeah.
it's this thing of of course, I would want to be met with no expectations as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely see, I think I see, labels as more decoration for myself than anything else, and I love decorations, but, I have no problems with it for myself, but definitely, some people might not want decoration, and that's fine, too. There's still, a very much real person. So.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I know. Absolutely. Oh, we are, I think, very lucky to be living in this environment because the world is not monochrome. There are so many different places on Earth where all of this is so incredibly different. So,
yeah. I think it comes down, I think, this is a larger thing, but there's, people are so different from one another, and, we're all human, but we're all just so individualized at the same time. We have very private, rich lives and rich identities, and, nothing's ever going to, I don't know, nothing's ever going to define it as well, but it's just, people are kind of just going to do whatever, and I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, even in the past, if you would have maybe in the 50s gone to a local rodeo or something in Wyoming, and you're looking at all these people, and on the outside, they're performing in a certain way in order to look a certain way. But on the inside, there's all this hidden diversity that just wasn't welcomed by that society. They couldn't be honest about who they really were, which
exactly.
brings, Brokeback Mountain to mind, although I think that was
yeah.
the 80s. But yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so... sadly, we are running out of time.
Oh, no. Oh, it's fast.
I know, right? So for everyone who's just joining us now, I have been speaking with Zoe Hanamakuta, who is the author of Gear Breakers, which actually, when did Gear Breakers come out?
It came out this past June.
Right, exactly. And it's a duology, so book number two is next June, 2022.
Yeah. It's called God Slayers, because I'm so dramatic, apparently. I love it so much.
You're like, I'm going to make sure that we definitely get into the religious side of the story.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I mean, I'm definitely enjoying this book. As I said, I never finish before an interview. I'm always worried I'm going to give a spoiler. But this is, you know, it's a good sized book, not too small, not Dostoevsky or whoever that person is who writes books that I have that keep your door open, but I haven't read yet. So this is like just awesome. So people who want to learn more about you, your website is?
It's ZoeHanamakuta.com.
Oh, nice and simple. MarchTwisdale.com is how you access all of my guest authors. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us today on the show. Zoe, really, honestly, awesome conversation.
Oh my gosh. I'm so at ease. You think I'm so nervous, but thank you so much.
My pleasure.